Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 422 for April 28th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes...
Clem put it to the directors of Powers that he would like to install a column still. Shock horror reverberated around the board of directors. A column still in John's Lane Distillery? Yes, yes, said Clem. I want to experiment by making gin and vodka, and we need a column still for that. But what he really had in mind was to experiment using the column still to make lighter grain-style whiskies.
40 years ago, John Ryan traveled from the U.S. to Ireland to help a new importer take over sales of a small Irish whiskey brand. That brand, of course, was Jameson, now the world's best-selling Irish whiskey. And this week, John Ryan is back in the U.S. to help jumpstart sales of one of Jameson's cousins, Powers Irish Whiskey. In fact, it's the whiskey his family created, and his uncle Clem may well be one of the unsung heroes in Irish whiskey history. More with John Ryan later on Whiskey Cast in depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's episode of Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Shoplifting happens all the time, never makes the headlines. Unless, of course, the thief walks off with a $26,000 bottle of scotch. That's what happened on April 7th at the Liquor Control Board of Ontario's Queen's Quay store in downtown Toronto. A thief brazenly managed to get a bottle of Glenfiddich 50-year-old scotch out of a locked display case, then picked up a bottle of much less expensive wine, paid for the wine, and walked out with the Glenfiddich under his coat. The LCBO's Heather McGregor isn't saying specifically how the thief got his hands on the bottle, since Toronto police are still looking into the case.
We are cooperating with the Toronto Police Service, and we hope that we can recover the bottle. We take theft very seriously at LCBO. We have surveillance in place, we use in-store security, and we have staff training to help deal with shoplifting and theft. But when something like this does happen, it's an opportunity for us to look at the way we do things and determine whether changes need to be made. So that is the stage we're at right now.
And, of course, your security cameras were sharp enough to get a pretty good picture of this guy.
They did. They got an excellent photo of him, and it was released by Toronto Police Service on Tuesday.
You'll find the security camera's photo of the suspect in the news section of the WhiskeyCast website, along with details on how to contact the Toronto Police if you recognize the thief. By the way, I tasted the Glenfiddich 50 several years ago. It's one of a handful of whiskeys that I've scored a 98, but it's still not worth risking a prison term for. Last week, Tennessee state lawmakers approved a bill that would allow for distilling in Chattanooga, but there's another bill headed for passage that would keep the Chattanooga Whiskey Company and other craft distillers from using the term Tennessee whiskey on their white whiskeys and moonshines. That bill takes the federal government's definition of Tennessee whiskey and expands on it. The federal definition only requires that a whiskey be distilled and matured within a single state to carry that state's name, in this case, Tennessee whiskey. But if the Tennessee bill becomes law, distillers would be required to meet the same standards for bourbon whiskey and use the Lincoln County charcoal filtering process in order to be able to use the terms Tennessee whiskey or Tennessee sour mash whiskey. That means Jack Daniel's and George Dickel would be the only distilleries that qualify, though there was an exception written in for Pritchard's Distillery in Kelso, Tennessee, which has been distilling since 1997. Distilleries that break the rule could lose their state distilling license for up to a year. And in case you're wondering, yes, Jack Daniel's and George Dickel could legally be called bourbons. The law says you can't call a whiskey bourbon unless it meets the federal standards for bourbon, but it doesn't make you call that whiskey a bourbon if you don't want to. Last month in episode 417, we got a sneak preview of Amrut's oldest single malt yet, the 8.5-year-old Greedy Angels, and went on sale this past Monday, which also happened to be Amrit Chairman Neil Jagdale's 60th birthday. The name Greedy Angels refers to the extraordinary angels share at Amrit in Bangalore, about 12% evaporation a year. Only 144 bottles will be available worldwide, and those came from two casks. Well, there's just one cask of the Glenlivet Kirkus, and it produced just 250 bottles after 17 years. Kirkus, of course, is Latin for oak, and the Glenlivet Kirkus was matured in an American white oak ex-bourbon cask. It's only available through the whiskey shop chain in the UK. Now, you're likely to find the Glendeveron single malt only in travel retail, except for a few other places. That's the name that the Dewar's folks bottle single malt from Macduff Distillery under, and there are three new Glendeveron releases coming out, 16, 20, and 30-year-old expressions. They'll be available at World Duty Free shops in the major UK airports and in Spain. And by the way, the name comes from the River Deveron, which runs right next to the distillery. I took part in an online tasting with Ballantine's master blender Sandy Hislop and several whiskey writers this week, about the same time that Ballantine's was releasing its annual golf limited editions ahead of this weekend's Ballantine's Championship tournament in South Korea. The 17- and 21-year-old Ballantine's bottles have been redesigned for the first time as part of this year's limited editions. You'll find them mainly in the Asian market as well as travel retail. We heard briefly about the Four Roses Secretariat Limited Edition bottling earlier this month. This coming Saturday is the Kentucky Derby, of course. 40 years ago, Secretariat set a Derby record that still stands today on his way to the Triple Crown. While 3,500 bottles of the Secretariat Limited Edition will go on sale this week, Jim Rutledge of Four Roses will be in Louisville Wednesday night with Secretariat's owner, Penny Chenery, to help sell a set of special Secretariat decanters for charity.
The decanters are all going to be sold at an event the Wednesday before Derby. It's May 1st at the Kentucky Derby Museum. In fact, the bottles that will be produced, the decanters, have already been purchased by the Kentucky Derby Museum. And they're selling tickets to an event on Wednesday evening. Penny Chenery will be there. Ron Turcotte, the jockey, will be there, and I'll be there. We'll have press reception, and then we'll be on stage talking to the people in attendance and answering questions. And the people can go online at the Kentucky Derby Museum website, purchase a ticket for $50 to attend that event, and that gives them the right to purchase a bottle for or decanter for $320.
And that money goes to the museum to help fund its education efforts, right?
That's correct. That's why the Derby Museum is using this as a fundraiser. They've purchased all the bottles, and all the proceeds go direct to the Derby Museum.
Tell me what it was like working with her to pick the whiskeys.
I tell you what, she walks in a room, 91 years old. She's sharp as a tack. She's a media expert. She knows how to handle media questions, field questions, and you can be in her presence, everyone there. I think there were a lot of people there that day. I can't imagine anyone saying within 5 minutes they hadn't fallen in love with her. She's a beautiful lady. It was one of the best experiences of my life, and I'll never forget it. I know that.
Look for the regular Secretariat Limited Edition bottles at retailers in the Midwest. And finally, there are a lot of ways to drink whiskey. But a restaurant in Philadelphia may have come up with one of the most unusual ways yet. One of the items on Pennsylvania Six's menu features beef marrow bones with garlic and herb-crusted marrow. The idea? You eat the marrow, then stick one end of the hollow bone in your mouth, pour some bourbon in at the other end, and you have what the folks at ThrillList.com referred to as a bourbon luge. Personally, I'll stick to a glass. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at WhiskeyCast.com. But for now, that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Cask Masters Project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on Glenmorangie.com.
Just a couple of reminders. This month's WhiskeyCast virtual tastings features our tasting panel gathered at Whiskey Live New York earlier this month. You can listen or download it at WhiskeyCast.com or with iTunes. Also, 2 weeks from now, I'll be heading up to Toronto for the Spirit of Toronto Festival, May 11th. Tickets for my tasting session are sold out, but you can still get tickets for the festival at spiritoftoronto.ca. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. Let's start off with an email from Justin Victor. Dear Mark, I'm going to violate the Dilbert rule about all that is good about email and put multiple subjects into one email. First, I recently read Whiskey Magazine's World Whiskies Awards and noticed that Whistle Pig 11 Years Old won Best American Rye. Is it safe to assume that by American, Whiskey Magazine is referring to the United States? If so, I find it odd that this one in this category, as last time I checked, Whistle Pig was made in Canada. Just an observation. Secondly, I thoroughly enjoyed the latest edition of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings and wanted to comment on your own rule violation on using whiskey industry professionals. I thought Ian Chang from King Carr was a great addition to the panel and offered interesting counterpoints to the other guests. When I conduct my own whiskey tastings at home, I like to have friends that have wide varieties of tasting experience. I think it makes for great discussion, and you get very interesting tasting notes. Perhaps for future episodes you will again get the chance to violate this rule and allow listeners insights into what other less heard or recognized professionals think of other types of whiskeys out there. Thanks, and as always, keep up the great work, Justin. Well, Justin, thank you for the note. First off, Whistle Pig's Triple One expression won the Best American Rye category, not the standard Whistle Pig rye. Just want to clarify that. I checked with Rob Allinson because I had a question about this one, too. Rob not only chairs the competition at the World Whiskies Awards, but he's also Whiskey Magazine's editor. And it turns out that Whistle Pig entered its whiskey in the American Whiskey category. And while I personally believe it should have been moved over to the Canadian Whiskey category, since it is bottled in the U.S., it was judged with American whiskeys. And full disclosure here, I serve as a judge in the World Whiskies Awards, but since it is a blind competition, the judges don't know what's been entered until after the awards are presented. And as for Justin's comment on having Ian Chang on the Virtual Tastings episode this month, it was a spur-of-the-moment call on my part, and I'm glad you enjoyed having him on the panel. I normally don't allow industry professionals on the tasting panels for WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings to avoid any conflicts of interest. But in this case, I decided that any conflict Ian might have would be minimal at best, and I'll consider doing it again in the future when we can make sure that there are no conflicts. Now, Brian Strike sent me an email with an ABV question. Hi, Mark. I have a question for your Why Are They Diluting My Good Whiskey column. Somebody asked me the other day when Highland Park 12 changed from 43% to 40% ABV. They were happy to have found a bottle of the old-style 43% on the shelf in their local liquor store. I thought to myself, what are you talking about? Highland Park 12-year-old is 43%. I just bought a bottle a couple of months ago, and I'm quite certain it was 43%. So I went over to my bar, opened up the liquor cabinet. Sure enough, it's 43%. I let out a big sigh of relief. However, before telling him to back away from the Glencairn glass and that he must be hallucinating, as Highland Park is and hopefully always will remain 43%, I popped over to the Highland Park website. Much to my horror, I discovered that they proudly advertised the classic Highland Park 12-year-old at 40% ABV. Fortunately, one of my favorites, the 18, is still listed at 43%. What's the deal, Mark? When did this happen? Inquiring minds want to know. Is Highland Park another victim of its own success having to ration the spirit to try to squeeze a few extra bottles out of every cask to meet increasing global demand? Or is this just perhaps variation between global markets? I hope that my old standby Highland Park 12-year-old, who I've recommended to so many novice Scotch lovers over the years, isn't really going to become 40% ABV. I look forward to hearing what you find out about this development, and I'm up for a blind taste test if you're game. Whew. Well, I went straight to the source for the answer, Highland Park's Jerry Tosh. He emailed me a response that should have Brian breathing just a bit easier. Here's what he had to say. The answer is quite simple. The USA is the only place in the world with Highland Park 12 and 15 at 43%. Everywhere else is 40%. This is due to old alcohol laws, which meant that imported spirits in the USA needed to be at 43%. The 12 and 15 have always been 40% and were first launched at this strength for Scotland. There are no plans to change the strength in the USA to be the same as the rest of the world. Brian, thanks for asking the question. I hope that answer makes you happy. And finally, Denny Hammer of Cody, Wyoming, posted this note on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com. Mark, thank you for pronouncing the new Talisker Port Rhee during your last podcast. I review many of the whiskey websites, and seldom do they inform the reader on how to say these Gaelic names. Any chance you can insert future pronunciations into your news updates? Well, Denny, that's a great idea. I've gone back and added the phonetical pronunciation for Port Rhee to the story on the website, and I'll do that from now on when I have the correct pronunciation available. I've got to be honest, there are times when your guess is as good as mine. If you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can do like Denny did and post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com, or you can email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com, and this week's Your Voice segment is brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at JohnnyWalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. I mentioned the LCBO in Ontario earlier. The Rideau Street store in Ottawa will kick off an Exploring Scotch Whiskey class on May 1st. If someone comes in with a bottle of Glenfiddich 50, call the police. World of Whiskey in Sydney, Australia will have a Dead Soldiers tasting with whiskeys from closed distilleries May 2nd. Of course, the Spirit of Speyside Festival gets underway on the 2nd and runs through May 6th. Tamdhu Distillery in Aberlour will have a special open day on the 4th as part of the festival. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's French chapter will have a party on May 7th at the British Embassy in Paris. The U.S. chapter has its final single malt extravaganza of the spring at the Brown Hotel in Denver May 9th. And the Canadian chapter will be part of a special charity tasting in Edmonton, May 11th. Right now, there are 265 different whiskey events around the world on the calendar of events at WhiskeyCast.com. There's bound to be one near you. The calendar is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, Master Blender, Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey.
The sherry butts in particular have a big impact on the flavour of Redbreast. It gives it the deep, dried, fruity notes, which is probably the signature of Redbreast. Take a sip, hold it in my mouth for minutes, and just dissect it and pick up all the little fruity notes. There's something that I didn't notice before. Whenever you leave your glass of Redbreast sitting there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you can go back to it and go, oh, something's changed there. Why is that changing? How is it changing? Is this something that I should be picking up on? You know, it's fascinating. And I mean, I've been in the business 34 years, and it still excites me, you know, things like this.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. 40 years ago, a young John Ryan traveled from Ireland to the U.S. Irish distillers had just changed distributors for Jameson in the U.S., and it was his job to help make the switch successful. Well, there have been a few changes since then due to mergers and consolidations, something that John and his colleagues at Irish Distillers know a lot about. But the plan worked. Jameson is now the best-selling Irish whiskey in the world. John Ryan has been in the U.S. again this week, and I caught up with him by phone from Chicago on Friday, just a few hours before Whiskey Fest. First of all, tell me what you're doing in Chicago, because I heard rumors that there's a no-age statement Powers, or is that the regular Powers that's available in Ireland that you were pouring at Benny's last night?
I'm in America because, as you well know, Jameson has been astonishingly successful over the last 10 years here in America and become a really trendy drink among young people. And we in Irish Distillers believe that the time is now right, that Powers, which is a deeper, richer, more complex whiskey than Jameson, and yet in the classic Irish tradition, is the time is now right for Powers to be promoted a bit more heavily in America, and promoted particularly to those Americans who are currently drinking Jameson and want to trade up to something with a bit more flavor, but without losing the unique Irishness. So that's the marketing thinking, why I'm here in America at the moment.
And as we've discussed before, Powers is really the Irish whiskey for domestic use over in Ireland, correct?
Yes, indeed. I like to describe it as the Irish prefer. And it was the leading Irish whiskey seller in Ireland for many, many years. And only in the last 4 years have the sales of Jameson in Ireland increased sharply, because young people in Ireland are proud to hear about Jameson's overseas success. And so Jameson's sales in Ireland have grown sharply recently, and it just currently slightly outpaces Powers. But certainly to most Irish people, Powers is the quintessential Irish and the one that the Irish prefer.
Explain the difference between Jameson and Powers. Is Powers made with a bit more pot still whiskey than Jameson, or is that putting it wrong?
No, that's putting it very rightly. Up to the 1960s, all Irish whiskey was made in the classic single pot still method by a mixture of malted and unmalted barley, and the malted barley, of course, was unpeated, and the unmalted barley added a little bit of sweetness to the final whiskey, and then distilled three times in the old-fashioned copper pot stills. And that produced a fine, full-bodied, elegant whiskey. But the reality was, in the 1960s, it was too full-bodied for the emerging tastes of younger consumers, particularly in America, who were looking for much lighter whiskies. And the success, for example, of Cutty Sark and J&B in America typified that people were looking for much lighter whiskies. So in order to stay competitive, we had to reformulate Jameson into the formula that you all know well at the moment, which is a much lighter, a more approachable, easy to drink whiskey, particularly for young people who are coming to whiskey for the first time. And Jameson has been successful on that basis, and now we believe the time is right to bring the more complex flavor of Powers back to the market.
I'm looking at the shelf behind me, and I see a bottle of the old-style Jameson from the 50s, sadly an empty bottle, but it's the Jameson Dublin whiskey. That would have been all pot still, correct?
Absolutely so. All the whiskey distillers of Ireland made nothing but pure pot still whiskey. The idea of having a column still in a distillery in Ireland was a shocking idea in those periods. And amusingly, my uncle, Clem Ryan, who was the young distilling director in Powers Distillery from 1957 onwards. His father, Willie Ryan, had been distilling director before him in Powers, and when his father died, Clem took over as distilling director, and in the early 60s, Clem put it to the directors of Powers that he would like to install a column still. Shock, horror reverberated around the board of directors. A column still in John's Lane Distillery? Yes, yes, said Clem. I want to experiment by making gin and vodka, and we need a column still for that. But what he really had in mind was to experiment using the column still to make lighter grain-style whiskies, because he believed that probably was going to be a necessary part of the future of Irish whiskey.
And let's talk about your family history. We've talked about this before a couple of years ago, but your family came from the Powers side of the Trinity that formed Irish Distillers, correct?
That's right. I have the proud honor of being the seventh generation of my family to have worked in Powers. My father and my uncle before me, and my grandfather and two granduncles, right back to 1791, made Powers whiskey. So that's a tradition I'm extremely proud of, and sadly, I'm a dinosaur. I'm the last of my family to be connected with Powers.
And let's talk about Powers. You mentioned it as the Irish that Irish prefer. The difference between that, of course, is the higher pot still content, but there were also some unique variations on that that made it more interesting initially during the early part of the Irish whiskey renaissance back in before Prohibition, correct?
Yes, that's true. Before Prohibition, in fact, all through the 19th century, I describe that as the second golden age of Irish whiskey. What happened in essence was that we all think of Scotland as being the a country that produced great engineers during the early industrial revolution. And after all, things like steam and steam engines were invented and perfected by Scotsmen. But when it came to the industrialization of whiskey distilling, it was Ireland who led the way, and Scotland followed long after. John Jameson founded his distillery in Dublin in 1780. John Power founded his in 1791. And several other big distilleries were founded around that time with enormous vessels and enormous industrial machinery to drive them. Before then, whiskey making in Ireland, and indeed in Scotland and everywhere else, was very much more of a cottage industry where the production was on a very low scale. But the Irish were the first to industrialize the production of whiskey.
And of course, with the antitrust and competition rules the way they are now, you could never bring together all five of Ireland's distilleries if you'd had to do it now. You couldn't pull it off, right?
Probably not. It is true, on the other hand, that in 1966, the date of the merger, the Irish whiskey industry had been bluntly going down the tubes for the previous 40 years. Exports had dwindled almost to a nothing. The only exports are really to satisfy the demand for Irish coffee, which is a very nice drink, but putting it into coffee masks or hides the true elegance and subtlety of the whiskey itself. And if Irish coffee had gone out of favor, then our industry really would have been, to all intents and purposes, bankrupt. So in the 1966 period, yes, there was every good reason to merge, and it was the right decision at the time, and the legislation certainly did not impede that merger at the time.
Now, was Powers the original whiskey for Irish coffee from Shannon Airport, the way I understand the story goes?
History isn't really quite clear on that point. Joe Sheridan, who was the barman in the small bar in Shannon Airport in 1947, he would have had in his whiskey stocks, he almost certainly would have had Jameson, he would have had Powers, he would have Paddy, he would have had Tullamore Dew, he might even have had some Bushmills. Nobody really knows which whiskey he used in those early days to make Irish coffee, but he made the point to any traveler coming through that Irish coffee had to be made with Irish whiskey. And that was the important thing. He made the point that the peaty, smoky flavor in Scotch whiskey fought in flavor terms against the flavor of coffee, whereas the absence of that peaty flavor melded very pleasantly with coffee, and that a true Irish coffee had to be made with Irish whiskey. Now, in subsequent years, we Irish distillers chose to use the brand Powers and to link that with Irish coffee. That was really more with the intention of de-linking Jameson from Irish coffee, because in the early years of our export trade, in the early 1970s, Irish coffee was about the only thing we had going for us, and yet we had to extricate ourselves from such a specialty, because Irish coffee was a one-way street, really. And the more we promoted Irish coffee, the more we were going down the one-way street, and the more we would have to reverse out of the one-way street to get back into the mainstream again. There was an English politician, he's still alive, a man called Dennis Healy, who came up with a wonderful phrase. He said, "If you're in a hole, stop digging." And that's what we had to do about Irish coffee.
And sadly, the John's Lane Distillery is no longer there. It does live on in name only in the Powers John's Lane expression that one can find over in Ireland. But that had to be a sad day when your family shut the doors, essentially, at John's Lane, right?
Yes, you're quite right. In 1966, the five remaining whiskey distilleries of Ireland merged together to form the Infant Irish Distillers Group. It is actually my father who was the moving influence behind that. He persuaded the directors of Jameson and the directors of Cork Distillers that the time had come to bury the hatchet of competition and to come together to relaunch, to represent, to reintroduce Irish whiskey to the markets of the world. And once that decision was made and the merger was complete, it was clear that the total production capacity in all of the old distilleries was too small, and there wasn't going to be the opportunity to make enough whiskey in the old distilleries, and that therefore a brand new modern distillery had to be constructed, which is duly done between 1973 and 1975 by a team led by my uncle Clem Ryan, who had been the distilling director of Powers, as I said, and became the distilling director of the new group after the formation. He headed up the team that conceived, designed, built, and commissioned the new Middleton Distillery, which came on stream in September 1975. Luckily, Middleton Distillery worked perfectly from day one, but as an insurance, they had kept open and working the old John's Lane Distillery, the old Powers Distillery in Dublin, for one more season, just in case Middleton had not worked in one form or another. But after the 1976 season, sadly, very sadly, the old John's Lane Distillery was closed down, and as you say, its name lives on in the John's Lane release, the single pot still Irish whiskey under the Power label.
And the buildings still live on as an art college, correct?
Indeed, yes. Sadly, the buildings of the old Jemison Distillery in Bow Street are largely gone and converted to many other purposes. But the main buildings of the Powers Distillery in John's Lane, the entire complex was sold to the National College of Art and Design in 1980. They were looking for new premises. And so now, charmingly, 600 or 800 art students come in and out of the building every day. That adds a great vibrancy and life to the building. So that's a proper renaissance for the buildings.
And the stills are still actually in place if one were to visit the college, correct?
Quite right. The cladding, the building that surrounded the stills, has long since gone, but the actual copper pot stills themselves, three of them, are still standing there as a type of almost modern sculpture, you might say. And on a sunny day, they look magnificent.
And a real tribute to Ireland's heritage, correct?
Absolutely. And nice to have them still there and to remind people of the past.
Now, you never did tell me what that no-age statement Powers was you were pouring in Chicago last night.
The range of whiskies that we're offering at the moment in America, the Powers Gold Label, which we know from Ireland, but that is going to be repackaged shortly with a higher ABV, probably 42% ABV, which increases the flavor complexity of the pot still content. The second brand we still offer is the 12-year-old Special Reserve. We call that the Millennium Whiskey. It was designed in Dublin for the Irish market only and was launched in the year 2000 to celebrate the millennium. But it was such a nice whiskey that our dear colleagues in Pernod Ricard USA said, gimme, 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 we want it in America. We said, we have quite limited stock designed for the Irish market only. But they stamped their little feet and insisted on having it, so that's available here in America also. But the sales of the Powers 12-year-old Special Reserve, frankly, are going at a much higher rate than the stock was designed to cover. And so there is a risk that that may run out of stock in the next couple of 3, 5, 7 years, who knows. On the other hand, the classic single pot still whiskies, which represented Ireland's skill up to the 1960s, they are very much enjoying a renaissance at the moment. And within the single pot still whiskies, there are two under the Powers label. The first is called John's Lane Release, which has a 12-year-old age statement. And the second is called John's Lane Signature, which does not have an age statement. And people are quizzing me about that. And the answer is quite simply, while it is nice to have an age statement, it is not true that a 12-year-old whiskey is necessarily better than a 9-year-old whiskey, or that a 15-year-old whiskey is necessarily better than a 12-year-old whiskey. The actual reality is a whiskey is ready when the master distiller declares it to be ready. And some of our single pot still whiskies are ready at 9 and 10 years. And they are of the opinion in Middleton that it's not necessary to wait for 12 years for some of these whiskies as important components. So John's Lane Signature has the flexibility to contain whiskies of many different ages, some of which will be younger than 12. And yet, when tasting these two whiskies to the public in Binney's yesterday here in Chicago, the reaction in all cases was that they liked the John's Lane release, the 12-year-old, very much, but they were astonished by the signature, which was the non-age statement, and in many cases they preferred it. So it just shows a whiskey is ready when the distiller says it's ready, rather than just waiting for it to acquire age.
Let's talk about Middleton for a second, because as your uncle was involved in the original construction of the new Middleton distillery, they're getting ready to fire up the stills now at the, I guess what you could call the new Middleton distillery with the expansion at the complex that pretty much doubles that capacity from what your Uncle Clem put together, right?
You're absolutely right. As I said, Middleton came in the stream in September 1975, and I remember Uncle Clem saying to me, "It's awful big, isn't it? I wonder if we'll ever use it all." And here we are, a mere 40 years later, and you're quite right. We're just completing a program to double the size and to double the production of the new Middleton distillery. Let's call it Middleton 2. It was currently producing just up to 50 million LPAs, and we're now going to be able to produce comfortably over 100 million LPAs. The buildings for the mashing, the fermenting, and the distilling are all in place. A lot of the stills are already installed. They will start producing new spirit probably in the month of September, and they have bought more land adjacent to the distillery to increase the number of maturing warehouses. Currently there are 44 enormous maturing warehouses on site, each containing approximately 32,000 American barrels, and the total population of barrels on the site at the moment is just over 1 million barrels of maturing whiskey of different ages, and the new land alongside will give us the opportunity to increase that substantially.
And the way I understand it from past visits to Middleton is that the guys are pretty much having to build a new warehouse every year just to keep up with expansion, right?
In fact, even more than that, for the last 10 years, they have been building and filling two more warehouses than they have been emptying. So they've been effectively increasing the stock of maturing whiskey by the equivalent of two warehousefuls every year for the last 10 years. So, but that's the commitment that we have to make in order to make sure that there will be whiskey in the future. Because at its simplest, tragically, if we didn't distill it 7 years ago, we haven't got it to sell today. And that's the commercial reality.
I want to get back to your Uncle Clem for a second, because you mentioned that little column still he was playing around with at John's Lane. That really sort of became the foundation for what we now know today is the current version of Jameson, and really is somewhat responsible for the entire Irish whiskey renaissance of this century.
Yes, Mark, you summarized that very accurately. It was becoming increasingly clear in the 1950s and 1960s that the classic burnished, emphatic taste of pot still whiskey from Ireland, while still greatly preferred by the whiskey drinkers of the day, it really was too pronounced in flavor for the younger drinkers of the world. And if we were going to have any success, we were going to have to do something radical to lighten some of our brands. And it was Uncle Clem's experimentation with the column still in John's Lane Distillery in parallel with the pot stills that allowed us to produce the first what we called Jameson NAB. We call that internally NAB, meaning North American blend. That was specifically designed for the American market. And luckily, it turned out to be absolutely right, because when we had enough of the Jameson North American blend, we introduced it to America, which was about 1973, really. The date when we transferred the distribution in America from an old company called W&A Taylor and transferred it to the Calvert Distillers division of Seagram Distillers, that was 1973. And that coincided with us having enough of the new Jameson North American blend to be able to bring it to market through Calvert Distillers. So that was 40 years ago, almost to the week, that I made my first ever visit to America with my whiskey hat on, and that was to supervise the transfer of the distribution to Calvert Distillers. So that was a seed that I was proud to plant in America 40 years ago. So you can imagine the pleasure I have now in seeing that seed coming to a wondrous fruition.
And your Uncle Clem only really passed away a few years ago, so he had a chance to actually see this boom that he helped create, correct?
Yes, Uncle Clem died only about 5 years ago, and in his old age he was extremely pleased that the efforts he had made to modernize, to bring the Irish whiskey industry up to date in the 21st century, difficult decisions, but they've turned out to be the right decisions, and that he played no small part in those decisions that bring us up to the success we're achieving at the moment.
Did he ever get the credit for this that he really deserves?
He was a very self-effacing man, as indeed my father was. And while I am proud of them both as my ancestors, I think they both would have shied away, I think, for looking for credit or praise. They would have said in all cases, no, it was a team decision. It was a team effort, and we all agreed as a team that it was the right thing to do. But I believe, looking at the work that they did, that they are entitled to credit for their foresight, if you like, of seeing what was going to be necessary to bring a really old-fashioned historic industry up to date.
By the way, that Powers John's Lane signature hasn't been officially announced yet. Consider this one a scoop. That's this week's Whiskey Cast In Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Discover Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, uniquely matured in two separate new white oak barrels. The second deeply toasted and lightly charred for a more complex dimensional flavor. Find out more at WoodfordReserve.com. Be double sure. Drink responsibly. Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume, Woodford Reserve Distillery, Brassailles, Kentucky. I want to do something different with the What I'm Tasting This Week department. As I mentioned earlier, I took part in an online tasting with Ballantine's Master Blender Sandy Hislop and a group of whiskey writers this week. You'll find my tasting notes for Ballantine's Finest and Ballantine's 12-Year-Old at WhiskeyCast.com. But I've got to be honest with you. The best whiskeys I tasted this week don't have any tasting notes for them. That's because I was at a friend's house on Friday night. I'm not going to mention his name because he's far too modest, but he had some neighbors over who were newcomers to Scotch. He started things off with a St. Magdalen single malt distilled back in 1969, and almost all of the bottles he opened up were rare ones from closed distilleries. The exceptions? A 33-year-old Glendronach and a 40-year-old Laphroaig. Now, it was really relaxing to enjoy a few drams without any pressure to put words to paper. And that's what I'd like to challenge you to do this week. I want you to just open a bottle up, pour a dram, and put the notebook away for a night. Better yet, have some friends over. Open up some of those bottles that you've been saving for one of those special occasions. I want you to enjoy the experience, both the drams and the conversation, without tweeting, Facebooking, or blogging about it, at least until the next day. You'll find my tasting notes for more than 950 different whiskeys at WhiskeyCast.com, along with episodes of WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings, the calendar of events, your voice, and a complete archive of past episodes. That's all at WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Whiskey Cast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.